Jeff Merrick, we have, of course, breaking news this morning in the world of hockeys. The Philadelphia Flyers have hired a coach that may actually take more than 1 or 2 years to win in Philadelphia, which is obviously huge news.
Yeah, and his name rhymes with the general manager's name as well, or is almost synonymous with the general manager's name. Which many people have pointed out. Dave Haxtell comes in from the University of North Dakota. That's a rare, eh, that you go right from college to the NHL?
I think they said it's the fourth guy that did it. Obviously, Mike Keenan's one guy that did it. Herb Brooks is one guy that did it. Yep. It's happened before. I find this to be amazing for one reason in particular, which is that it was cited by Ron Hextall during the press conference that part of the familiarity he has with Dave Haxtell is the fact that his son, Hextall's son, played at North Dakota. And I'm just thinking to myself, you know, forget about that six-pack of Miller High Life that you buy your kid's coach to try to get him more ice time.
Get him a job in the NHL.
Hiring your kid's coach as the head coach of the Philadelphia Flyers is the single pimpest hockey dad thing that's ever happened, I think.
It's not bad. So attention all coaches out there. If you have a kid whose father is an executive in the NHL, I recommend it is in your best interest to play said kid as much as possible. Make sure they get the full 2 minutes on the power play. And don't worry about that pesky, I don't know, back-checking and penalty-killing. Leave that up to some other non-NHL parented child. Let's just do that.
Put that out of your sweet brains right now. Brad Schlossman, by the way, is coming up later in the show. Brad is a guy who writes for the Grand Forks Herald, one of the best college hockey writers in the country, and he's going to join us to give us the skinny on Dave Haxtell. But here's the press conference happened moments before we hopped on this special edition of the show. It's a little bit early, obviously, to accommodate many things, including this press conference. Ed Snyder says, I hear something in my ear. That's another station.
Yeah.
They're talking about the Indianapolis 500. Can you hear it too, Merrick?
No.
All right. Anyways,
for once, my connection isn't the problem.
That's good to know. So,
is it still there?
Yes, still there. Ed Ron Hextall says about talking to Ed Snyder about Dave Haxtell. He was great. When I started going down this path, I told him the short list we compiled, and he told me to get the best coach and the right coach. And we got him. So my question to you is, Merrick, is there any way that 105-year-old Ed Snyder was told, hey, we're going to hire a college coach with no NHL experience? And he said, he lifted up his Crypt Keeper-like finger and pointed to Dave Haxtell's name and said, this one will do fine, Ron Hextall.
Well, you know, in one sense, though, it is a breath of fresh air. And it is...
Totally.
This is a real leap for the Philadelphia Flyers, a real leap for Ed Snyder, because Dave Haxtell is not an ex-Flyer, right? This is going outside that network of, did you wear the orange? Good, we have a job here for you. Many teams have been plagued by that, most, you know, obviously the Edmonton Oilers, who continued up until a recent note with, you know, people like Bob Nicholson and Peter Chiarelli, went back to that, well, was he one of the boys on the bus? And if the answer was yes, you got a job. And if he didn't, then, you know, try somewhere else. So I wonder if now, you see, because everything in hockey is mimicked by everybody else. Where once upon a time it was, you know, you only hire from the alumni club and that's it. Mm-hmm. I wonder now if now, because there has been that inevitable backlash, mainly from fans who usually go something like this. Oh, great. Another X insert team here. This is just the old boys club, and if you're not a member of the squad, you're never going to get in. I wonder if now the backlash is going to become the fad, and teams are deliberately not firing from the alumni anymore.
I like the one thing that Hextall said a lot today, which is that he said, you know, if you gave me the choice between hiring a National Hockey League assistant coach and hiring a guy that had been a college coach for 11 years, I'd take the head coach every time. And I think that's a really underrated aspect of all this stuff, which is that there's such an obsession in our sport of going and doing the NFL thing, which is hiring the best coordinator from the best coaching staff, right? But it does miss the fact that, you know, there are guys that are really good worker bees, and then there are guys that are really good managers. And, like, if a dude's been a coach for 11 years at one of the most high-profile college jobs in all of college hockey – he's doing something right. He kind of gets it, kind of knows what he's doing behind the bench. I do like that concept of simply not just going, oh, through osmosis, Dave Lewis will be an amazing National Hockey League coach. Or, you know, through osmosis, Bill Peters will be an amazing, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's not to say that it's not the case. It's not to say that it's – but here, I'll give you the best example, Adam Oates. There are certain guys that are just better assistants than they are head coaches.
Could be,
and if Adam Oates ever went to college, I think he'd probably have the same results as a head coach as he would in the National
Hockey League. He went to RIT. What are you talking about? He was one of those high-priced free agent guys coming in. Anyway,
here's
the interesting thing about it is, too – as much as it is a, hey, look, new blood in the NHL, hey, no one saw this coming, isn't this a fantastic story? There is something to be said for at least having a shot at the American Hockey League or as an assistant coach to learn how to coach professionals with long-term contracts. That would be the only knock. And listen, I don't know how good a coach Dave Haxtell is going to be. All indications are, you know, he's a very serious hockey man, very furrowed brow, did wonders at Nodak for a lot of years. I don't know how he's going to do, but if you look at experience and you look at, well, you know, he hasn't – it's one thing to do it with kids. It's another thing to do it with grown-ups. You know what I mean? It's another thing to be able to say, hey, you know, I know how to handle this guy. I've been in this situation before, or I've seen this situation arise. I know how to handle it. It's a big difference. And listen, this happens to junior coaches. Happened to Peter DeBoer when he made the jump from the Kitchener Rangers to the Florida Panthers. Like, it happens. Mm-hmm. Like, that, you know, there is a learning curve and an adjustment, which is why I'm kind of surprised the Flyers did it, because I've always been of the impression Flyers aren't looking to rebuild, they're looking to reload, and they want to jump right back into the playoff conversation. And not the playoff conversation, the Stanley Cup conversation next year. But it seems as if when you go out and hire someone like Haxtell, you're saying, we're going to grow along with, we're going to let this coach grow alongside us.
Yeah, and as we've talked about many times in this, I was going to say, we talked about this many times on the show before, like the reinforcements for the Flyers are on the back end. And one of the things he specifically said during his presser was, I am a huge believer in activating your defense and it being a mobile defense and being a defense that gets involved in the play, which has got to be music to the ears of Shane Gottes Be Here.
Good Lord. Or Travis Sanheim or Samuel Morin.
By the way, I interviewed Dave Haxtell during my trip to North Dakota. Remember when I went to North Dakota a few years ago?
I remember
ago?
That. Yeah.
Yeah, it was one of three great highlights. The first, of course, being that I went to the Olive Garden that nice old lady reviewed in the newspaper that one time, and one of the greatest viral moments in the history of journalism. I interviewed the Mount Lamoureux twins, which is obviously high on anybody's list. And then also I interviewed Dave Haxtell. We sat down for about a half an hour, and he was very insightful, very interesting dude. We talked a lot about the college game versus the pro game and everything else. I'm really hoping I have that recording somewhere so I can repurpose it today.
He seems like he's really on the ball.
Yeah.
Real sharp. Now the playbook on Dave Haxtell is he's ultra serious.
Mm-hmm.
Like is that true? Because I've never met the man.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes. My recollection of my interview with him, it was like interviewing someone who might be ex-military. And I don't know if he is or isn't, but it was that kind of vibe.
Hmm.
That's sort of like very to the point. Literal, you know, nothing. It ain't interviewing, you know, Bruce Boudreaux. Let me put it that way.
he's not kind of away chuckling.
Yeah, but I was like thinking, it's like, okay, it makes sense. I mean, he's like, you know, Midwest coach or upper Midwest coach, and that's the kind of demeanor that they have. It's sort of a non-ironic sort of approach to life. You know, it made a lot of sense to me, at least. But you know, the thing you said is so true about coaching pros, and it's two things that Haxtell specifically mentioned about the college to NHL jump, which was, one, you go from coaching kids that don't make any money to guys who make more money than you do. And then the other thing is the jump in the number of games you coach, which I think is a really underrated aspect of the college to pro leap for players and for coaches, which is an 82 game schedule is a very unique beast, you know?
Yep. That's a great point, too. I hadn't thought of it vis-a-vis coaches, but, you know, we see it. The stereotype has always been, you know, you start to see around late January, early February, and we saw it with Johnny Gaudreau for about 15 games this year, right around that time. You hit what's called the college wall, where you're like, whoa, this schedule is really catching up to me here. I'm not used to playing this many games. I'm kind of starting to feel burned out. That's a that's a great point to make about coaching.
Well, for coaching, it's more like
I hadn't thought about it in that context. But it's like
watching the Preakness, right? It's like depending on how long the race is how early you give the whip to a little horsey, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with coaching. It's like you got to know when to put the pedal down. You got to know when to be able to exert the most out of your team and when you don't. And that's the difference between, say, being a team like the Tampa Bay Lightning and being a team like the St. Louis Blues. One team is still playing and the other team isn't. I'm just saying there's a slight difference there between the teams.
Between Ken Hitchcock and John Cooper.
And maybe the energy that they exert over the course of a season.
Could be. When is that going to be official, by the way?
Hitch?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that big picture thing, because we've talked a lot about the Flyers situation and how this whole thing shook out today. But Hextall offered a no comment on Babcock. This is very big, by the way. I know a lot of people that thought the Flyers were the smart money as far as the place he would go if he left Detroit. And so him not being there, I mean, them not being in the equation anymore. What do you think about that? How do you think this affects Babs' watch?
I think it's down to three teams: Buffalo, Toronto, and the Detroit Red Wings.
How much?
And man,
you're up there. How much stock do you put in this Toronto thing, or is it just using them as a stalking horse for getting the money you want to get?
I was skeptical at first, but I'm growing warmer to it. I still think. I mean, Buffalo, as I mentioned on the podcast last week, Buffalo is going full bore. Like Tim Murray is going all out to get Mike Babcock. It's referred to it last week as the full court press, and that's true. He's really pitching hard. I think the Maple Leafs get one of the two Detroit coaches. They either get Mike Babcock or they get Jeff Blashill.
Yeah.
That's from if I'm reading the tea leaves correctly here, the way it shakes out is you're looking at either Babcock or Jeff Blashill as a head coach of the Maple Leafs and Sheldon Keefe as a head coach of the Toronto Marlies. That's kind of, as you look at the chess pieces on the board here, that seems to be the way it's shaken out. But, man, I still can't believe, you go to that interview last week with Dreger, with Holland and Babcock.
Yeah, I sat them down, get any information, but I did sit them down so everyone could see Babcock in flip-flops.
And a golf shirt. The thing that was interesting about the interview, regardless of what sounds the two gentlemen made with their mouths, was the fact that I saw it and I said to myself, I have a hard time believing Ken Holland would go for this right now unless he had a pretty good indication that Mike Babcock was coming back.
Yeah,
I agree. How do you look? You know what I mean? Like it just seemed like such a bizarre one to me unless, you know, he's coming back. But I know how hard Buffalo is pitching. I know how hard Toronto is pitching as well. The decision will come at some point this week. Maybe by the time this podcast gets uploaded on iTunes, we'll already know the answer. Maybe by the time this podcast is off the air, I'll have the answer.
I think if you look at the timeline I put out in that interview, I told you Wednesday. And today is, by the calendar I'm looking at, Monday. So obviously I'm looking at Wednesday, not Monday. There's two different days. About 48 hours difference by my clock.
Did you get that feeling when you watched it? Like, why is Ken
that
Holland
it's totally
doing
bizarre
this?
That Ken Holland would sit down with a guy who's going to leave him, you know, and leave him high and dry. Yeah.
I don't know.
Unless it's like, whatever you say, Mr. Babcock, I'm here for you, Mr. Babcock. You want to do a TV interview? Sure thing, Mr. Babcock. I don't know.
That's not Ken Holland, though. Ken Holland's like, look, you want to go look elsewhere? Go ahead.
That's the other thing I'm trying to figure out. Like I saw this again this morning with some people talking about Babcock. And again, they keep on saying stuff like he wants to have like a hand in player personnel control and stuff. And it's just like, I don't buy that. First of all, I don't buy that he doesn't already have it with Ken Holland. Right. And then the other thing that I don't get is that, like, if he went to San Jose, let's say, tell me, Doug Wilson's going to cede it to Mike Babcock?
Nope.
I don't know.
Nope. There's no that, especially now with that dynamic, considering how well the general manager thought of by the owner. Like, really, Doug Wilson's in a great spot in San Jose, as I'm told, in that the owner isn't the strongest hockey guy around and relies a lot on Doug Wilson. So Doug's in a really good spot there. He's in a really good spot in San Jose.
It is going to be so interesting to see what happens with Buffalo if Babcock stays in Detroit and Blashill goes to Toronto, McClellan goes to Edmonton. Was that official yet, by the way? That's not official yet, right?
McClellan? Nope. Not that I've seen, nope.
It's going to be real interesting to see what happens in Buffalo. Because the Luke Richardson thing is the thing we all thought for, like, eons there. Because it was connection to Tim Murray.
Still think. That'd I think the fallback for Toronto is Blashill. I think the fallback for Buffalo is Richardson.
How about... Nah, I don't know. I'll say it anyway.
Go for it.
How about Ronnie Wilson in Buffalo?
Yeah, I could see it. It would make the QEW rivalry spicy, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if he'll ever get another job, though, because he was such a loudmouth. Like in the last year, right? Like, didn't he say that he was told to throw games by the Capitals? That's not a good look for a guy looking for a job, right? Speaking of the Caps, three things in the Caps real quick. First off,
okay.
Sports Business Journal reports today that Verizon Center will not be Verizon Center come 2018. Verizon's dropping the sponsorship.
Won't be the food. That's a drag.
I don't know, but that's a long-standing one though, dude. That's like the building open with that name on it. That's going to be pushing 20 years with that name.
So who goes in? Do we know?
We don't know. I'm sure it'll be something. I opt for something DC centric. Ben's Chili Bowl Arena is where I would go with it.
Irish Channel Arena.
Oh my God! Just build an extension bridge from Verizon to the Irish Channel, so we don't have to cross the street.
Yeah, great set.
The other thing is, Brian McClellan said today that the Caps are going to be in the market for a top line right winger to play with Ovi and Backstrom. What do you think about that?
There's not going to be Joel Ward.
It doesn't sound like they have that level of confidence in young Joel Ward to be the top line right wing. They said they're going to be looking for one, which I think is very exciting for some right winger out there.
Toronto has one.
Go and play with those
available.
Two guys.
Yeah, Toronto.
Could you imagine
that? Right winger.
Holy shit.
Toronto's got one of those that they're out there looking to move. You know why it'd be hilarious?
To have an Ovi Kessel,
yeah,
romance.
Sorry about that whole All Star Game photograph thing, Phil. Hey, dude, no problem.
Yeah, for sure.
It's okay, bro.
Maybe tonight we go to the condominium and play video games.
Yeah, sure. Whatever.
Yeah, sure.
Fine.
Okay, cool.
And then the last Capitals thing. Boy, I had it in my head and now it's gone. Oh, the right wing thing. The Mike Green thing?
The Mike Green thing.
Like, they're basically saying he can come back if he knows his role and shuts his mouth and takes the money they want to give him.
Yeah,
you know
I don't know.
Which I can't imagine that's going to be the case, right?
I don't know that. Yeah, I don't know if the Caps really want a $6 million fifth-six pairing defenseman. It's to the point where I don't even think the Caps make him an offer because they don't want to insult him.
Yeah.
Knowing that someone, maybe Detroit, we'll pay a bigger buck for him. I would be shocked if Mike Green came back.
What's your deal now? Do you have to boogie? Because I know you got a busy day.
I do. I got a boogie. I'm in the middle of a million things. All right. Essentially, this is prep week for Memorial Cup for me.
Real quick before you have to go, your thoughts on the game ones that we saw over the weekend?
Holy Ryan Kesler. That's what I'm taking away from the weekend. Holy smokes. Ryan Kesler.
Beast mode.
Yeah. Never thought we'd see. Remember that? Well, of course, we all do. The 2011 performance against Nashville and San Jose. Mm-hmm. Never thought we'd see it again, right? Man, how close are we?
Blackhawks must be kicking themselves. They had possession. They had the possession advantage for the first two periods. Yeah. Anderson played well. Crawford, okay, it's all right. Things happen.
Yeah. To me, the takeaway of the weekend is Ryan Kesler. He's freaking fantastic.
And game one of the Bolts Rangers series, I'll just say right now that has me a little bit worried about Tampa and their time spent in these playoffs, because the more you look at it, the more it looks like a team with three really good lines going up against a team with one amazing line, one really good line, and a team that has three solid defensive pairings going up against a team that has two very good defensive pairings and one absolutely atrocious one at this point with Carl and Schuster.
Yeah, although it's tough with Yandel and Boyle. There's just no way to sugarcoat
it. But they're not a total. Look at what happened with Rundblad yesterday, and look at what happened with Carl and Schuster whenever they're on. I mean, I just feel like Tampa. Watching those two teams on the ice maybe it's because the playoffs gives you clarity and the playoffs allows you to see the depth of experience with guys like Dominic Moore, for example, who was great in that game. Sure. But you just start to look at that Tampa Bay team and you say to yourself, when it's not the triplets and when it's not Stamkos, what do you have? Especially when you move Fupala up to the top line. Holy god damn. It was like, it's like Stamkos line, triplets line, and then just go use the bathroom for a few minutes because nothing's going to happen unless the Rangers score.
Try to play to a stalemate. Your guest is standing by, and I got a boogie. So I will talk. Are we doing tomorrow? Am I going to talk at you tomorrow?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure thing.
I'll talk at you tomorrow.
There goes Jeff Merrick, ladies and gentlemen, gentlemen and a scholar. Brad Schlossman is a really solid writer, one of the best college writers in the country. And I was just telling everybody, Brad, that I was in North Dakota way back when and got to meet you, which was really cool. And now you're here on the show to talk about the head coach of North Dakota becoming the head coach of the Philadelphia Flyers. Who saw that one coming, Brad?
You know, I definitely didn't see this coming, not right now. I remember a few years ago, ESPN did a piece on they picked out the most likely head coach at each level to wind up in the NHL, and they did project Dave Hextall as the most likely college coach to go to the NHL. But, you know, when no head college coach has went straight from there to the NHL since Herb Brooks in 1987. So, you know, it's just wow. Not something that happens too often.
Did you have any inkling that that Hextall had interviewed other places or had been discussing his future with other places through the years? Because he kind of made mention of the fact today that the NHL job was always paramount to him, but I don't think we've really heard his name linked many places in the past.
No, I think he's also a guy who really keeps things close to the vest. Someone even asked me about 3 months ago if I thought he would ever get an NHL head coaching offer. And at that time, I said, I actually wouldn't be surprised if teams have talked to him before and we just never heard about it. And you know, obviously, he had been talking to the Flyers for several days and we just never heard about it. So they kept that close to the vest. And I would not be surprised if it's happened before. But, you know, it just... With the infrequency that NCAA coaches become head coaches, it's tough to tell that it's happened a lot of times or how many times it's happened. But I wouldn't be surprised if this was not the first contact.
Hextall is a guy I only spent like a half an hour with when I was up there. But in knowing a little bit about him and in having talked to him, I tend to believe he has the right temperament for a job like Philly. What do you think?
Absolutely. And I think he has the right temperament to, quickly gain respect to the players and have his voice be heard. You know, I heard in the press conference someone asked, how do you get the players to, buy into a coach that's never even played in the NHL? And, Ron Hextall's response was, they'll find out quickly who's in charge. And I think that'll get a lot of laughs up here because everyone knows how true that is. I wrote a story last year about Dave a little bit, and one of the players talked about his famous stare. We all talk about up here the Dave Hextall stare, and he said it'll penetrate the back of your helmet. And, he doesn't necessarily even need to, he's not necessarily always a yeller or screamer. I mean, he said all he needs to do is look at you, and that you did something wrong. So, I do think he has the right temperament to, get players to respond to them. He's obviously been very successful doing that here. As far as everything else that goes along with it, I know in the NHL you lose two games in a row and everyone wants the coach fired. And, people are, jump off ships quickly there. So it'll be interesting to see how that all goes. But I do think he'll handle it well.
Hextall should have just said when he got that stupid question about Hextall having never played in the NHL, he just should have said, I don't know, go ask Steven Stamkos how he buys into a coach that's never played in the National Hockey League, who, by the way, is still coaching in this postseason, right?
Exactly. John Cooper was, his rise to, become the head coach there was a little bit non-traditional, going up through the USHL and everything. And So, I don't think there's any one clear-cut pathway or anything like that where you have to be an NHL assistant or you have to be an American League coach. You know, there have been guys who've come from major junior and, you know, coached in the NHL and done well. And so I don't think just because he's coming from the college level will hurt him at all.
Yeah, maybe I just have a trigger when people say you haven't played the game and they assume you don't know anything. But that's my own personal journey.
You have to play pro hockey.
He certainly has. One of the things that they talked about today vis-a-vis his experience level, and Hextall did say that his experience level or lack thereof in the National Hockey League was the only box that wasn't checked for him. Everything else was what he was looking for in a coach. One of the things that was said about North Dakota is the way he ran that program was like a pro team. What can you tell us about that kind of comparison?
Well, I think so. You know, I think just the expectations he has out of his players. I think the standards he wants his players to live up to on and off the ice, their training, their off ice training, everything, kind of how they handle themselves with their, you know, just basically everything, how they run their program is more like a professional program. I've heard that a lot. One of the things that I'm really interested in seeing is his teams have been really successful playing more of a physical style and really wearing out opponents. And, you know, this last season, in college hockey, for those that don't know, you play Friday and Saturday nights. And you play the same team both nights, and UND didn't lose a game on Saturday until March, after they had already won the league championship. The night after they won, they finally lost a game in March. So teams had a terrible time trying to come back the second day and play them again. And I'm really curious to see how that plays out if he gets into the playoffs and gets in a seven-game series, and if his teams are able to play the same style and be able to wear down opponents like his teams have at North Dakota.
Yeah, there you go. This was a real out of the box one for the Flyers, and I kind of like it for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. I guess the question came up: what kind of style he plays? I mean, is there a discernible Dave Hextall style of on the ice play?
I think one of his probably the biggest pluses for him is I think his teams they don't always play the exact same style, but they play a style that they need to in order to win games. Sometimes he's had really explosive teams up front. They'll like to run and gun with anyone, but they also don't mind to play a physical game. This last year, they really didn't have a super explosive team up front, but they were really good on the back end. He really expected his defenders to get involved all the time in the play. UND led the nation in scoring by defensemen this last year. Once again, that was they played to the strength of the team, I guess, is what I would say. You know, 2 years ago, it was supposed to be a rebuilding year, the year they ended up going to the Frozen Four in Philly. They had a lot of new players that year, and they found a way to win a lot of low-scoring games and grind out games. So I think one of the biggest pluses for him is he's been able to take the different personnel groups he's had, and he's had success with every single one of them. You know, they've had a 600 winning percentage every season he's been the head coach. I don't think any other college program has done that in the last 11 years. So, I think that's probably something that was really attractive to Ron Hextall.
Again, we're talking with Brad Schlossman about the hiring of Dave Hextall by Ron Hextall for the Philadelphia Flyers. And again, like you said, I mean, the activating the defense thing I think is going to be huge for the Flyers, considering the youth movement they're going to have on the back line coming through. So that's always a good thing there. So I guess finally, and thanks for your time and giving us some insight onto this guy and what he's made of. What are your thoughts about him as a National Hockey League coach? Like, what's the biggest concern that you have about him making the transition, maybe besides the obvious more games and trying to coach guys that actually make some money instead of getting dicked over by the NCAA every year as far as the money that they don't get?
Well, I do think the big thing would be the difference in games and, the intensity that you use to push your players. At North Dakota, he became masterful at getting his teams to peak down the stretch. It's almost a joke around college hockey. You know, anytime UND maybe started a little slow, well, it's a Hextall team. They're going to be rolling everyone come February or March. And sure enough, every single year, this team was on fire at the end of the year. One of the things I know he did is he would adjust practice times here at North Dakota, where as the season went on, the practice times came down. It was more important to keep his teams fresh at that point. He did a great job of keeping his teams fresh the entire season, and at the end of the year, it paid off big time. I'm curious if this changes the way, you know, he runs practices in Philly when you're doing twice as many games, and how little things like that play out, whether he's still able to get his teams to have be at their best at the end of the year, because it was every single year here that they would just be on a roll come the end of the year. And I'm really curious to see if he can work that there, and if he has to make adjustments based on keeping guys fresh.
Real quick, 20 seconds. What are they going to name the team up there now at North Dakota?
Oh, boy. The fans don't want a name. And if they go to a public vote, and that's one of the options, they actually will not have a name, I don't think. I think they'll just keep going University of North Dakota.
That's so badass. I love it. All right, Brad. Thank you so much, man. It was a pleasure to have you finally on for a good reason. You're one of our favorites, and keep up the great work. And I'm sure it'll be a busy day for you because they just named a coach up there, too. So thanks for the time.
For sure. Thanks for the chat, Greg.
That's Brad Slossman, Grand Forks Herald, and a really great college hockey writer who gives us all the insight that we need on Dave Hextall. Here is someone who will give us much insight about the National Hockey League and specifically the Ducks Blackhawks series. Kenny Albert, one of our favorites here on the podcast, joins us to talk NHL puck. Kenny, how you doing, man?
I'm good, Greg. How are you?
Doing well. First off, I guess I should just ask you, what did you think about the Flyers hire today?
Well, to be honest, I just heard about it about 10 minutes ago. I got off a red eye and slept for a couple of hours, so kind of just taking in the news.
Yeah, I it was sort of a surprise this morning, too. I think a lot of us were wiping away the crust from our eyes after watching Mad Men and crying our eyes out last night, and here's Dave Hextall getting hired by the Flyers. All right, let's just move off of that then. Ducks, Blackhawks, it was a very interesting game in the sense that I think the Blackhawks had the better of the play in the first two periods, but the Ducks showed great resolve and showed some very opportunistic scoring, I felt, yesterday.
I agree. I thought Joe Micheletti and I talked about it along with Brian Engblom during the broadcast. The Blackhawks certainly did have the better of the play over the first two periods. They outshot Anaheim 16-7 in the first and then 25-15 over the first two, but they did score opportunistic goals. Lindholm in the first and then Palmieri in the second, and got great goaltending from Frederick Anderson. So I think if you're Joel Quenneville, you're probably not too unhappy with how your team played, because you did take it to the Ducks for the first 40 minutes, but the goaltending was a big factor, and they scored the timely goals, like I said.
Yeah, and Merrick said it before, too. Ryan Kesler was all over the ice yesterday, too.
Yeah, it really was. We saw that Kesler-Taves matchup throughout the game, and they battled at the faceoff dot, and Kesler did take the penalty in the third, and the Ducks were able to kill it off, but I thought he played a real strong game.
Yeah, and it was interesting to see that matchup, too, because I think the anticipation for all of us coming into the series was going to be the Taves-Hosa-Saad group with probably Oduya and Yarmolson going up against the Perry Getzlaff group, but it's kind of tough to get that matchup when you want it, when you don't have the last change.
Right, and we spoke to Bruce Boudreau before the game yesterday, and he mentioned that Chicago does a lot of changing on the fly, in particular on the road where they don't have the last change. But Boudreau seemed pretty, you know, okay with either of his top lines against either of the top two Chicago lines. But what we did wind up seeing throughout the game was Kesler up against Taves.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting to see how that develops, especially when the action kicks back to Chicago. Anderson played really well yesterday, and I think that a lot of people that may have not watched the Ducks through those Jets and Flames series are getting their first glimpses of him. What impressed you about Anderson yesterday?
Just overall solid play. You know, the save on Kane is probably the one that stands out in the first period when he got his stick across. But I haven't seen too much of him, you know, working primarily in the Eastern Conference. And I know he had his ups and downs during the year. And in March, when the Ducks were in New York, you know, there was still a question then. I remember talking to Boudreau that morning on who he would wind up going with in the playoffs. Would it be Anderson or Gibson? But Anderson's taken the net and run with it. And he's 9-0 at home now in his career in the postseason, and 9-1 this season overall, no matter where the game's been played. So he's really, you know, had an eye-opening postseason for the Ducks, for those of us who haven't seen him as much as we would if we lived out on the West Coast.
And I guess the last thing on this series would be the unfortunate life and times of David Rundblad, who comes in because Roosevelt gets hurt. He's on the ice for the first two goals. There's a giveaway on one of them. Is this just, I mean, what did you see out of that third pairing for Chicago, and is it going to be a concern going forward?
I think it certainly is a concern. When you look at Timonen and Rundblad, you know, Timonen's minutes had been down when he was the number six with Roosevelt there prior to his injury. And yesterday, Timonen winds up playing just 5 minutes, 15 seconds, and Rundblad 10:47. And Rundblad's on the ice for the first three goals of the game.
Right, three goals,
scored,
right?
By Anaheim, yeah. And one by Chicago. So I think the other thing it does, it mixes up the pairs. You know, we saw Keith and Seabrook together a lot, but then at times it was Keith and Rundblad. So aside from the fact that you're primarily going with four, it also juggles the pairs when you do throw out Rundblad and Keeman in at times with some of the others.
Moving over to the East, you have covered Henrik Lundqvist for so long. Are you does it never cease to amaze you how clutch this guy is?
Well, we've certainly gotten used to it, Greg. 10 years now, he's been to the playoffs 9 out of 10, 3 Eastern Conference Finals, 1 Stanley Cup Final to this point, a President's Trophy. And what I always point out to people is the 7 years prior to his arrival, they missed the playoffs all 7 years. It's not a coincidence that coinciding with Lundqvist's arrival in North America in October of 2005, they've gone 9 out of 10, and the other year they lost in a shootout on the last night of the season to the Flyers. And this is a guy who, when he came over to North America, was expecting to look for an apartment in Hartford to go play for the Hartford Wolfpack. Well, that never happened, and it's just remarkable, night in, night out, and he's saved his best for some of the most important games. When you think back to Game 7 in Pittsburgh last year, Game 6 against Montreal, and then really all the games in the Stanley Cup Final, even though they lost 4 out of the 5, and then the last 3 against Washington this year as well.
40-0-1 this season for the Rangers when they're leading after two periods, which is pretty damn remarkable. And I guess the other thing about the Rangers, obviously, in Game 1 was the play of Dominic Moore, the play of that line that Vigneault put together of Moore, Hagelin, and Saint-Louis that I thought was really the best line on the ice for at least the first 40 minutes of the game. Dominic Moore, quintessential role player in this league and a real heart and soul guy for the Rangers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you as far as how that line played. I thought Saint-Louis played his best game in a while with those line mates. I think you know, their styles meshed together with Hagelin and Moore. And it's ironic, you know, they lose Zuccarello, who's such a big part of the team, but due to that injury, they wind up moving Moore up, and they move Jesper Fast up to the Kreider-Stepan line, and it certainly worked out. And Kevin Hayes, I felt, looked good with Nash and Brassard as well. Mm-hmm. So little tweaks by Alain Vigneault prior to Game 1 certainly paid off.
Yeah, he's a coach that doesn't get enough credit for, and I've been trying to preach the gospel of AV throughout the year, and I'm happy he got a Jack Adams nomination, because I've been really impressed in watching the Rangers this season, living in Manhattan, seeing more games live than I've seen before. The adaptability of this team to other styles. You know, they can play the trap. They can shut it down. I've seen them be more offensive in the regular season than they've been in the postseason. But he's got a real knack for making adjustments, more than most coaches do, I think.
No, I totally agree. And you know, we as broadcasters have the vote for the Jack Adams, and he was certainly one of the three on my ballot. But, you know, first you look at the adjustments he made when he came in last year and changed the style that the team plays. And it took some time early last season. You know, they were blown out a couple of times in San Jose and Anaheim and really started off slow, but came on and played their best hockey from late December on. And then this year, kind of similar, December 15th on, they were nearly unbeatable. And you really have to credit Vigneault and his coaching staff. And Scott O'Neill, you talk about the play that he drew up in overtime in Game 7 against Washington, and the job that Ulf Samuelsson's done with the defense, and Benoit Allaire with Henrik Lundqvist, and they added Darrell Williams to the staff this year. But I think you have to give a lot of credit to the entire coaching staff from Vigneault on down.
Exactly. And I'm really happy that you broadcasters got the nominations right. I mean, as you know, the writers are infallible when we do the voting, like, you know, trying to put Ovechkin on two different all-star teams and stuff. So it's nice to see the broadcasters holding up their end of the bargain. Anyways. All right, Kenny, you're the best. Thank you so much for taking time after your red-eye flight and all that jive. And you got game two tonight or no?
Well, game two tonight on the radio side, and then back to Anaheim for game two on TV tomorrow night. So crisscrossing the country a couple of times, but it's a lot of fun. It's the best time of the year.
How do you handle plane rides? Are you a sleeper, or do you, like, watch videos and TVs and movies and stuff?
Was able to sleep a lot last night. The flight took off at 9:30 L.A. time. Had some reading to do on the iPad for a little while, but got about 3 hours of sleep and then three more at home. So the big day is tomorrow, the early 6 a.m. flight out to L.A., and then the game, and then the red-eye after the game on to Tampa. So tomorrow's the big one.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kenny Albert. Pour a little out for Kenny, for out of respect for the efforts that he gives all of you people. Kenny, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Greg. Anytime.
Kenny Albert, ladies and gentlemen. A couple things before we go. Got to cut a little bit short because I have an interview coming up soon. Radio thingy. Let's see here. Okay, Anaheim, Chicago series. Like I said, Chicago dominated possession. Thought they were the better team. Thought the matchup between the Kane line and the Taves, the Getzlaf Perry line was real interesting. And I'm going to be very interested to see once Quenneville gets the last change in Chicago, whether it's going to be just copious amounts of Taves and Saad and Hossa for that line if he gets the matchup. Because he did have the opportunity to get that matchup a few times in that game and opted for the Kane line instead, at least early on. So interesting to see what he does there. As I said about the Rangers series, it is unbelievable how good the Rangers are when leading after two periods. Once they scored that late goal, you kind of knew what the writing was going to be on the wall, even with Tampa coming back in that period. The Lightning, to me, have to figure out a way to get to the net better, 5-on-5. Their power play was awesome, and they had a couple more opportunities on it that didn't pan out. But like I said, it bummed me out a little bit to see the disparity in the depth in the lineup, because the other two lines for the Lightning outside of Killorn, Fupula, and Stamkos, and then the triplets line were just non-entities. And I don't know if it's a case where Cooper has to kind of mix it up a little bit, maybe drop Fupula back down. I don't know what he has to do, but it was the Rangers rolling three great lines and then getting something out of their fourth line as well against a team that was very top-heavy. And it was a bit of a disparity. And it could just be one team's been there, one team hasn't. I don't know what it is, but it looked a little bit like someone who had finished the book report versus someone who got an incomplete, if you know what I'm saying. Two things before we go, pop culture-y. Mad Max Fury Road is so damn good. One of the best action movies in the modern era, without question. Practical effects for the most part. It's a two-hour chase movie, and it stops maybe like four times, but it has amazingly rich character development for being this kind of movie. I felt Tom Hardy was a bit of a cipher, but that's okay because all the stuff happening around him was so good. I do wonder if there was a way to go back and get a young Mel Gibson and put him in that movie, if it would be even better than it was. But I mean, I was talking to a couple of friends of mine that have a hesitation because they've not seen any of the other Mad Max films. It doesn't matter. You just have to know he's a former cop whose wife and kid were murdered. And then I've also talked to some people that just had apprehension because they're not a huge fan of that genre. And I'm like, if you went to go see Furious 7 and liked all the car stuff there, then go see this for that, because that's what it is, on top of having George Miller's, you know, continued mastery of being able to present pop entertainment while also having some really interesting underlying tones and narratives and comments on the patriarchy and comments on dictatorships and comments on religion in some cases. It's freaking great. Go see it. Mad Men last night, as I tweeted last night, three interpretations of the final scenes. If you've not seen it, shame on you. You should see these things when they happen, because otherwise you're going to get it all spoiled for you. As you may know, it ended with than playing the I Like to Teach the World to Sing Coca-Cola commercial from the 1970s. It's one of three things. It's either Don Draper slash Dick Whitman finds enlightenment at the end in the hippie commune, and we are meant to see that that he finds his smile. He no longer has the trappings of Don Draper. He no longer has the trappings of Dick Whitman. He is now something different, is the thing that we are meant to believe, perhaps. That's one reading, but I prefer one of these other two readings. The most popular is that the entire episode was a setup to have us have Don go back to McCann, who made the Coke ad, and make the Coke ad. And there's evidence to that fact throughout the episode. The most direct one being that the girl at the receptionist desk is dressed like one of the women in the Coke commercial. I also thought that the first face that you see in the Coke commercial looked like a young Helen Slater, who played sort of Don's muse in the commune. There's a lot there. There's a thing I tweeted out, an image of Don looking out on this beautiful on these beautiful cliffs and seeing a bunch of the hippies kind of doing Tai Chi together. And it almost looks like he's brainstorming what that would look like in a commercial. And also, as many people pointed out, the original concept of that Coke commercial, I believe, was to do it on these cliffs in Ireland. And so maybe the first thought from Don would be to put the whole thing on cliffs too. So there's a lot of thought there that Don, in that moment of Zen, breaks through with his next great idea. And there's one other line that I'll harken back to, which is in the episode in which they decide to take the buyout from McCann, in which Don gives Teddy Shaw a speech about how as much as Teddy wants to get out of it and he's done with it and he hates the business side of things and he kind of hates himself, he's sort of self-loathing at this point and what he's become, Don kind of indicates that no matter what you try to do to divorce yourself from the business, you're always going to come back to writing. And I wonder if maybe that moment of clarity, that moment of finding oneself was reconnecting with that very advice that he tried to give Teddy. Unless that stuff to Teddy was just a pitch, which it could have been as well. Finally, the other reading is Don spends the last few episodes stripping himself of everything that was Don Draper, making peace with who Dick Whitman was in every way possible, and finds inner peace, finds serenity, and yet at the same time, the advertising world finds a way, as it always does, to co-opt that innocence, to co-opt that spirituality, and turn it into some commodification of that thing, which is what Don spent his entire career doing, taking things like love and family and the relationship between a child and a parent, things that should be bastions of purity in our society, and commodifying them to then sell someone a cigarette or a cheeseburger or a car. So whatever the reading is of the final scenes in Mad Men, I think it's one of the greatest endings to anything I've ever seen, because it's open-ended to the point where you can go several different ways with it and feel smart about your response and feel satisfied about where you think what it was saying. And it was divisive, but not divisively disappointing like The Sopranos was. So I give mega kudos to that show for having the cojones to end like that and also end in a way that was just super and stuff. Anyways, thank you so much for your time, everybody. We will talk to you, down the line tomorrow, and there you go. Take care. Bye. Oh, thanks to Brad, and thanks to Merrick, and thanks to Kenny Albert. Sorry, I was reading someone complaining about the Conn Smythe watch that we just put up on the blog. I don't know why people have a problem with it. Real quick, the list, if you want it. Conn Smythe watch, latest one. Henrik Lundqvist, Corey Perry, Tyler Johnson, Patrick Kane, Frederick Anderson, Duncan Keith, Ryan Getzlaff, Derek Stepan, Ben Bishop, Jonathan Taves. Keep in mind that in some of these cases, like, there are just guys that are in the queue ahead of some of them. Like, Stepan's been awesome, but, like, Lundqvist is going to win the Conn Smythe for the Rangers in the Cup. I mean, there's if you could just give it to him now. Anyways, thank you so much, everybody. Oh, Phil Coker. I'm sorry, Wyszynski. Are you saying Philpula or Fupula? I don't care. You know who I'm talking about. And, you know, if you have a problem with the way I pronounce things, might as well just quit the show now, because Shane Gottes Be Here is coming. Anyways. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Me and Merrick back for the full show tomorrow. Talk to you soon. Bye.